Ars Electronica 2008. A new cultural economy.
Not that I had any doubt about the technology, but So thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. Ars Electronica is, as you know, a very special sort of event. So, and I've made a pretty terrible mistake. One of our topics this morning in the list of nouns, one of them is truth. So I have made the tragic error of deciding to sort of talk about truth. And in particular, truth in the age of information, and to wonder eventually what sense it might make to think about truth as a property of the network. So I want to start way at the beginning, and I'll try to be very fast in this review of, and yes, I'm only talking about truth in the Western tradition, so that's my scope here. It's pretty well settled in that tradition what truth is. We have a pretty good idea. It's a correspondence theory. And in the past 40 or 50 years, there's, of course, been a great deal of movement away from that. Nevertheless, we have a couple of thousands of years in which this has become the settled standard conception of truth, that truth is the correspondence of a statement with a state of affairs, with the world. So that the statement, the cat is on the mat, is true if the cat is on the mat and becomes false if it's not on the mat. So that's about as simple as it gets. Correspondence truth thinks that truth is a property of statements, which is not obvious, right? But that's what truth is. It's a property of statements, according to this view. And because a statement is true because of its relationship to the world, and because there is only one world, these are the assumptions, then there's only one truth, and thus a truth must be a universal truth. The world is only one way or another. And of course, we have assumed and hoped that these universal truths go together in interesting ways that reflect the simplicity and yet the systematic nature of the world itself. So it's not just a pile of truths. They work together because they mirror a world that works together. We've also assumed in the West, in the back of our minds, if not in the front, that truth is scarce, that people say all sorts of things, we believe all sorts of things, but truth is rare, truth is scarce. And because truth is scarce, it thus has value, and there's an incentive to own it. The universality of truth ties it to a world that we're really not all that happy with traditionally, because the world just keeps on changing. It's really hard to pin down. And that gives rise in the West to a tradition of fascination with truths that we can know to be true without reference to the world. You don't have to worry about the messy world. We prefer the truths that are true no matter what state the world is in, that are independent and formal and abstracted from the contingent messy world. That's what we like. This universality expresses a discomfort that's at the core of our understanding that gives rise to the correspondence theory. The world and our understanding of it seems so different. Our awareness of it and the world itself seems so different in the West that we've spent several thousand years trying to figure out how those two things could ever come together. And the correspondence view of truth reinforces this notion. It supports it, relies on it, reinforces a metaphysics that tries to answer the question how our minds could ever know what's going on in the world. It assumes and reinforces the famous Cartesian dualism and is therefore a type of representationalism. That is the idea that we don't experience the world, we rather experience a representation of the world inside our heads. This is a deep, deep alienation from the world that's characterized Western thought for thousands of years, that this representation stands between us and the world, is how we see the world. Well, it seems to me an odd thing that correspondence truth works so beautifully, formally, with the broadcast infrastructure that we've developed, the one-to-many infrastructure that we've developed, because broadcast, first of all, is about beaming pictures of the world into our brains. This is an exact representation of the view of correspondence truth, of this representationalism. And because the economics and the technology itself of one-to-many, and by broadcast here, I don't mean simply TV and radio, but any of the one-to-many media, which includes books, any type of publishing, that sets up a set of conditions, which also mirror the conditions of correspondence truth, because its access to the one-to-many media is by definition rare and scarce. It's one-to-many, and not very many of us get to be the one. Most of us get to be the many. So the access is quite scarce, and what comes through, therefore, is assumed to have gone through a process and thus has some authority, is more likely to be right, has more truth to it. And there's even a sort of claim to universality, because the economics of broadcast favors reaching as many people as possible. And so within the domain that the one-to-many relationship, the broadcast reaches, you want to have stuff that is as universal as possible. So the mirroring is really pretty close between correspondence truth and the broadcast regime. Along comes the information age. Truth looks a little different in that age, but not deeply different. So in the age of information, we break things into little pieces, little symbolic pieces, and then we reassemble them. And so we can create models of the world, which are like externalized representations. So now we can actually see, we can model and build externally the representations that had been traditionally inside our own heads. And good reasons for doing this. These models idealize the world, they simplify it, they make it quantifiable, make it more manipulable and more controllable. But we get confused. We confuse the model for the thing modeled. And this may be along the lines of the sorts of errors that James was just pointing to. So we confuse the model for the things modeled. For example, Ray Kurzweil, who has done many, many wonderful things in his life and is a genius, but is also down the singularity path, which is just plain weird. So in The Age of Spiritual Machines, his book, he wonders when computers will be big enough and affordable enough that we'll be able to model in them, in their programs, in their silicon, model the 100 billion neurons in our brain. Because, why do this? It's interesting in itself, but actually Kurzweil has something else in mind, of course, which is that if we can do that, if we can model our brain in silicon, then Kurzweil thinks this model is him, and he will live forever. So long as there are backups, there will be a Ray Kurzweil. This is a crazy idea, and the fact that it even makes sense to us, that you know what he's talking about, what I'm explaining of what he's talking about, the fact that this even makes sense to us indicates just how informationalized we've become. That is, how much we've taken the ideas of information theory and science and internalized them. Understand, we've understood and reinterpreted our own consciousness and the world and our relationship to it in terms of information. That a model could be the thing is, and it's not just Kurzweil, it's not just our ideas of consciousness, it's also, as you know, business frequently now confuses the model of the business with the business itself. It gauges success by the model. We had the Cold War that was run, that consisted primarily of two sides engaging in war games, modeling wars and building weapons and deciding which weapons to build and where to point them based upon how the simulations of warfare worked. So it's not just singularity. I mean, this is deep throughout our culture, this informationalization. So how did we get here? Well, it goes back to Claude Shannon, who, of course, created information science and thus started the information age in a radically new way. I mean, it took over a term, information, gave it a radical new meaning. and in 1948 wrote the paper that started it all. And in that paper, it's a highly technical paper. It's all math. I can't understand it. But a diagram came out of it that it's familiar to us. It's a very familiar diagram, even though it seems to me deeply weird. The diagram says that we take information, we encode it, or we take a message, we encode it, we put it through some type of medium or channel, and then we decode it. That's how information transfer works, that's how communication works, that's how language works. That's what that diagram says. The really important thing about this that made information science so useful and important was that Shannon purposefully and explicitly abstracted information from its medium, from any medium. So what Shannon is saying, what his theory applies to information, whether it's being passed through the internet, over the air, by carrier pigeon, which is actually, I guess, also through the air, but it doesn't matter what the medium is. And because it doesn't matter what the medium is, because it's so abstracted, information science, Shannon's theory, can be applied to everything from consciousness to how we encode information on a hard drive and move it reliably into a computer, to understanding the genetic code. And of course, the code of that comes from our adoption of information. The fact that DNA looks like code comes from our adopting information science. So, completely formalized, abstracted information. So, in this paper, Shannon takes over a few common terms in English, very non-technical terms, message, encode, coding things, and signal. And I don't want to talk about those at all. I do want to focus for a moment, though, on noise. Noise is it's sort of surprising. Here's this highly technical paper, and he's talking about, noise. Oh, I know what noise is. Of course, we don't know exactly what Shannon, but nevertheless, very common word. So how did noise, why that term as the enemy of information? Because the top line is the perfect information flow, and then noise is interrupting it. So in this theory, noise is to information as mere seeming is to truth. But why noise? And there are a couple of reasons. One is that Shannon was working for AT&T, and so telephone lines have noise, very literal. But there's another reason as well, which is a whole bunch of the cohort of folks working on information theory who took up Shannon, who provided the basis for Shannon, then took up Shannon's work. They came out of World War II, where they were working on related topics. And one of them was this very distinct problem. All of this, by the way, is described in a wonderful book, The Closed World, by Paul Edwards. excuse me. So there's this problem on a battlefield. You have a commander issuing a command, a soldier. The command cannot be heard by the soldier because war is really noisy. It's really noisy. And so there was a project that they set up a center at Harvard during the war and to work on the problem of the transmission of commands. And they came up with 1,000-word controlled vocabulary. From this project came the Able Baker Charlie. This is Charlie Company, Charlie Fox, which you may know from American military movies. But control vocabulary for spelling out letters plus 1,000 other things. And as you know, this then maps very nicely to Shannon's overall view of information. So what happens here is we take an example, a problem that's rare. That's unusual. It's wartime. It's very noisy. War is unusual. We're very happy to say war is an exceptional case. And in that exceptional case, you have a message. You have to encode it into this controlled vocabulary, decode it, and get the message out. That model works perfectly when you're yelling over the sounds of guns and artillery cranking. But to think that exceptional case is the model for all human communication is the sort of mistake that philosophers make over and over again, taking the exceptional and using it as especially revelatory of the normal. Our theory of communication that comes out of information theory is based upon the problems of communicating on a battlefield, and it may not be the best environment for deciding what human communication is. So we have noise, and at the top of this we have the pure information flow. The abstract, almost platonic movement of information. Noise is interesting, I think, because noise is actually the world. In Shannon's theory, noise is the real world that gets in the way of this perfect exchange of information. It's the only place in this abstracted theory that the world shows up. It shows up as noise, as what gets in the way, as what intrudes, what distracts, what distorts, what works against our understanding and our ability to communicate. It is the world is that which is not formal, which refuses to be formal, which refuses to stay put and to shut up. So now let's talk about the net for a moment. So the net is, as you know, it has particular properties. It's totally non-systematic. It's open. It's extremely messy. It's miscellaneous, if you prefer, as some of us do. It's full of difference, right? I mean, that's what makes the net useful and interesting, is that not everybody's saying exactly the same thing. It's not like a printing press, not like a steam-driven printing press. As ACMA says, you know, it's everything on it is different and in contention, and that's also the great difficulty of the web. But it's also its greatest strength. It's essential to the web that it contains difference. In other words, the web's really, really noisy. And that's its strength and occasionally its weakness also, at least its challenge. And by the way, if you want to read a really good paper on the importance of embracing difference in your hermeneutics, there's one by this guy. If you Google ACMA and differential, you will get to his paper. The simple universality of the one-to-many media, of broadcast, the one signal fits all, simply isn't enough anymore. We can't, everybody in this room, we can't stand it anymore. We would feel difference is beating down on it. Difference is the desire for difference is breaking that apart. It's just, the broadcast realm simply cannot contain difference, not enough difference. The difference on the net shows up not just in all the different nodes that are there, but within nodes. It's quite common for difference to manifest itself in a variety of ways, fractally within each of the nodes, whether it's a blog or it's a Slashdot or it's a Flame site or if it's Global Voices or if it's Wikipedia. The Sarah Palin page, I'm assuming enough familiarity with dreadful American politics, so I don't have to explain her. Because I can't! The Sarah Palin page at Wikipedia is a really good Wikipedia page. You know, want to know about her? Great, go there. It's a very good source. They've done a good job. But the talk page about the Sarah Palin article is fantastic. It, as far as I can tell, is the single best source for understanding Sarah Palin. Go there. Because there you will see, this is just the list of topics that are covered there. You will see people arguing. You know how Wikipedia works. You know how the talk page works. Right? This is the single best source precisely because it manifests the difference. It's there that you see the differences in conversation with one another. So why don't all encyclopedias show us this? Why does the Scottish Encyclopedia Britannica show us their talk pages? Well, it's easy to be snarky about it, and I've frequently been snarky about it, to say, well, they Britannica and other encyclopedias, they want to maintain their authority and talk in this tone of voice as if they never had a doubt about anything because they have an economic and a psychological interest in doing so. And I think that's right. But from their point of view, they don't say that. Britannica doesn't say, well, they don't say, well, we want to appear authoritative. No, they say, and they think genuinely something different, which is the emails that go back and forth between the editor and the author and the different drafts and the arguments, all that stuff, that's noise. That's, to them, literally, that's the noise. That's the distraction from keeping you from the final product that is the perfection. To them, that's the noise. But for Wikipedia, and I think for most of us, the noise is exactly where the value is. It's exactly that's where it is. Because this is noise, this is difference that is in conversation. It's not merely a bunch of subjectivities. It's noise that's in conversation. So I don't want to be too optimistic, and I think that Jamie has made this point quite well. Sure, there are lots of differences, but we also know that each language edition of Wikipedia, to continue that example, is quite homogeneous. The people who wrote the English language version, at least initially, tended very heavily to be well-educated geeks. You know, and reflects their bias. Of course it does. It has to. We're human. And so these are imperfect objects. But at least now, not only are there multiple language versions, but the multiple languages are beginning to connect with one another. And that's exactly the sort of thing that we need to do in order to get past the tendency to talk only with people like us. It is wildly imperfect, but it's way better. It is deeply better than what we had. It's not only deeply better than the broadcast one-to-many environment we've been in, it's also more truthful. There's more truth there in the difference and in the conversations, in the difference, in the noise. So what does a truthful network look like? Well, you know, it's linked, it's persistent, it's open to everyone, to everything, and the people on it are increasingly sympathetic. Increasingly never done. We can't be done because as creatures, we're torn between self-interest and care. The net is simultaneously an amplifier of our comfort with others, our desire to be with other people like us, and our also, I think, innate interest and curiosity and sympathy and caring about others as well. It amplifies both of those things. We don't get to where we need to be by sitting back. Just as in the 19th century, Americans had to build elk clubs and wear the funny hats, we don't get there just by sitting back. Not enough people read Global Voices. We need Global Voices, we need more Global Voices, we need more people reading Global Voices. But the net gives us a chance, unlike any other we've ever had, to do this, to reach out, to understand how the world looks to other people. I should point out that from my point of view, the linked and persistent nature of the web, that's not at risk, that's going to be fine. The openness is deeply in danger politically in various places around the world, including in America. And the sympathetic nature of it, the thing that's never done, well, that's a perpetual human problem, but we can't just sit back and wait for our humanity to solve this problem. We have to continually re-engage and try to move beyond where we're comfortable. We will always fail at this. We will. We just can't do it. But at least now we are not faced with this dreadful choice between correspondence truth that says, if I'm right, you're wrong. There's only one way. If I'm right, you're wrong. And so my choices are either to kill you or convert you. These are not good choices. But that's what we've been stuck with the correspondence view of truth. In a networked world, if truth is something like a property of a network, if that's where we look to find truth, not in the individual pieces, but in the sympathetic relation and discussion of unsystematic differences, then that's to say, well, there's a possibility for a noisy peace, for peace that is really noisy, but in some sense also truly peaceful. A noisy peace seems to me to be the only one that's possible. This is a task that's difficult, that's never done, that's full of difference, it's full of contingency, it's full of the accidents and interruptions that simply are human fate. But a noisy peace seems to me worth celebrating. And I might add that noise is really hard to own. Thank you.
David very commendably kept us 7 minutes for questions, and I'm going to misuse the moderator's prerogative and ask the first one. So since I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying, let me attack it violently. Isn't what you're saying, A, impossible, and B, a bad idea? Impossible because to the extent that it really works, it only works because we have this secret notion of correspondence truth lurking in the background. So that at the end of the day, there's always an at the end of the day, I look at the ranting on the site about evolution, and I decide to say that even though there are more people saying that evolution is wrong and more people saying that actually God created the fossil record and more people saying that evolution's just a theory, that I actually have a vision which, albeit it's not quite the correspondence theory of truth, is a theory of truth which actually gives superior credence to a particular way of understanding the world, namely the scientific method. And because I've been educated in a particular way, I know to knock out a whole lot of those comments and say, yeah, there's a lot of people saying things, yeah, it's all in the edits, but it's just crap, and it is just noise. And I knock it out because of a correspondence view. And then the flip side of that is, so that's the it's impossible part. And then the it's a bad idea part. the difficulty with the network theory of truth is it sounds wonderful because we tend to think of conversations as good, as being peaceful, as being progressive, as being respectful, and so forth. But the thing about conversations is, unless you have some metric for truth or authority, like this person is an evolutionary scientist, they actually probably know more than this person is screaming at them, then you take intensity of preference or intensity of utterance or frequency of utterance as being indicative of truth. It's like, well, there's like 1,200 postings saying evolution is wrong. I guess it must be wrong. So the question is it a good idea and is it possible?
It's impossible to do successfully, the fundamental fact that all of human history has established is that we're not going to agree. We're not, as a species, we're not going to. We've had thousands, if not more, years. We're not going to agree. So we have to do something with that fact. It is certainly the case that we all maintain beliefs, and to believe something is necessarily to believe that it's right. Right? You can't believe something and simultaneously believe that you're wrong and believe it. That's not a characteristic of correspondence view of truth. It's a characteristic of belief, and we cannot get away from it. But we are now increasingly faced with a world in which the fact of difference, of disagreement, is so apparent that we can either, and there are those, as you well know, who say that in fact what's happening is that we're retreating further back and hardening our beliefs, which certainly does happen, we can have the quality of our belief shaped by the fact of disagreement. That's what's required. So I simultaneously believe in evolution, and want to get past the point of thinking that those who, on the basis of faith, disagree are simply wrong. They're not simply wrong. They're wrong in very complex ways. There is something truthful in what they're saying, and that can be, and thus something wrong in my belief. My characterizing people who believe in that God created the earth, in the creationist point of view, as either stupid or ill-informed is probably not always the case. That's, an interesting question. What is it that they're believing that... in essence, I'm a liberal. So I believe things, but also try not to believe them so fully that I feel the need to convert or kill. And it seems to me that the web is either going to drive us into enclaves that are more strongly believe what they believe, or I hope that they will drive us to qualify our beliefs better. I don't think it's a natural, I'm actually agreeing, I loved your presentation. I thought it was neither impossible nor wrong. And I think I'm agreeing with it. That this is not something that's going to happen simply because it's there. It's something that we have to do. This is one reason why I love Global Voices so much. It's one reason. It's something that we need purposely to set out to do, individually and together. And I think our fate actually rests upon our ability to do that. But this is an opportunity we've never, ever had before.
So we have time for one more question. And then we're going to have a break.
I promise to be short. Yes, no.
It's a combination of both James and your talk, which is both of them very good. I'm right here. Sorry.
Thank you.
The question I have is, in both talks we discuss truth and the idea of the openness of that in the case of arguments. But in the case of current trends with information, for example, search, right, the idea that we're implicitly making a decision about, say, evolution or creationism by how many times you search for that object, and that thing comes up in Google as an answer for more and more people over the years, and over the time people use that search engine, or things like Dig, where people have the ability to rank up the idea of truth or knowledge or popularity. How do you see that trend moving forward in terms of more of an implicit argument, saying that people can make the decisions about truthfulnesses implicitly by what they're looking for, and whether that's real or not? If people search for the definition of an apple as an orange, and that comes up, and someone searches for orange in Google, and it comes up as an apple. Do you see what I'm saying?
This is also the anti-folksonomy argument,
right.
The masses of people may mistag something and thus that becomes the category that it's in, even though it's not in it.
That's right. And those people doing it, maybe not explicitly as tagging it, but in their implicit way of looking for things.
Yes. Yes, that happens. We go wrong. I'm just going to have to agree with James again. There's nothing set here that says magically it will work out that we'll all get smarter together. What we have, however, are conditions that enable us to get smarter together, to build tools and to build cultures that are smarter about how to progress towards shared truths and shared knowledge. But neither is it the case that we've just been thrown into this world and now we all have to search Google to find out what something is. Because look to the person next to you. That person has probably built something to get over the very problem that you're addressing. They've built Science Commons. They've built a tool that helps find or connect or relate. That's what we've all been doing. And we're going to keep doing it because we understand that it's not enough to throw people into a world of noise and hope they come out sound, because they won't. This is something we need to do. It won't just happen. But whoever said that peace would just happen?